two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Americans are pulling back from the values that once defined it, created it, and caused it to flourish. That's the headline from the Wall Street Journal, who released the results of a new survey with the University of Chicago. But as always, we have to go past the headlines and beneath the numbers. So why are we seeing a decline in the importance of family, religion, tolerance, and patriotism? And has America really changed that much? Or is there more to the American story? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
So yesterday, the Wall Street Journal released a new poll in conjunction with the University of Chicago talking about some of these core values and how they are perceived by the American people. And in looking at those numbers, it's an interesting poll to break down. The headline was very much about pulling back from things like patriotism, tolerance, faith and religion and family. And if you look solely at the top line numbers, you would say, wow, drastic decrease in the commitment to all of those principles and values in our country. And that could spell some real challenges. There's much more to it than that. And so we're going to dig in a little different way today as we look at these numbers from this particular poll from the Wall Street Journal and the University of Chicago. But I want to go back to a conversation we had yesterday on a completely different topic. We were talking about what was going on in Israel. We were talking with our friend Amos Giora. And as we were looking at the potential overhaul and now the pause and changes to the judicial system there in Israel, he made the most interesting comment that I think applies to what we're talking about in terms of these core values in the U.S. and have we really retreated from them. Amos said that part of the problem that led to the point that they are at in Israel is the fact that they stopped teaching an important subject in schools.
Democracy is fragile, and we made a terrible mistake in Israel. 20 years ago, we stopped teaching civics. We thought people would learn democracy. I don't know how, what we thought. It was a terrible mistake. I think one of the things, you know, if you want to, by analogy, to extrapolate to here in the United States of America, we should never take democracy as to be a given. You have to teach it over and over and over and over again.
And so I love that Amos was taking that very application, that very issue of patriotism, democracy, that commitment to it, and that it is fragile. It is indeed fragile. And so if we look at the numbers from the Wall Street Journal, 38% of respondents said patriotism was very important, and 39% said religion was very important. Now, that was down sharply when they first took this poll back in 1998. When over 70% deemed patriotism to be very important, and 62% said so of their faith and religion. So that's an interesting thing. Tolerance is another one that is interesting. Tolerance for others deemed very important by 80% of Americans as recently as 4 years ago has now fallen to 58% since then. The numbers get really interesting when you start looking at people under the age of 30. Only 23% of adults under the age of 30 said that patriotism was very important. Just to give you some comparison there, 59% of seniors over 65 said that was very important. And so in the very important category, we've clearly lost an edge and a lean-in factor when it comes to patriotism, when it comes to faith and religion, when it comes to family, and even when it comes to tolerance, which is is really stunning to me, that our tolerance for those that are different than we are has fallen in such a significant way. Now, we also had an interesting conversation yesterday with Dr. David Bobb from the Bill of Rights Institute, who also connected the dots in some of this, who talked about civics and history education being important because it teaches the why, and it also teaches that critical thinking we have in a constitutional republic.
If we're doing civics and history education, if we're doing learning really within any subject area, but it can come out especially well in civics and history, you're getting to those why questions. History often gets a bad rap. It's memorization of facts and dates, and that's not very good history education. You do need to know content, and we start with content. You need to be able to apply that content, and ultimately what we're seeking is young people who examine our history, who examine their own thinking, and are open to the ideas of others, that they that you build in that curiosity so that their lessons are teaching them to think about a point-counterpoint, a kind of iron-sharpens-iron perspective.
So having those conversations, having that tolerance enough where we can have conversations with those that we disagree with or those who look different or think different or live different than we do, that's an important part of the conversation. And being able to, I love that idea of iron on iron is what really sharpens things. And we should do that in our critical thinking. We should do it starting in elementary school, and it should go all the way through the highest levels of our institutions of higher education. So that's a critical piece of the puzzle. Now, I want to add in one other component, and then we're going to look under the numbers to see where we really are. So last week, I had a conversation with Ian Rowe from the American Enterprise Institute. And he explained that having strong institutions, family, religion, education, entrepreneurship, those are the things that drive very different outcomes when it comes to society.
This state and this city are incredible examples of what happens when you have very high functioning, strong families, strong rates of marriage, low non-marital birth rates, high levels of faith commitment, more educational choice. Again, there always could be more.
Yeah.
But it means something that the non-marital birth rate in this state is only about 19% relative to the rest of the country. It's 40% across the country. These are devastating, what I call equal opportunity tsunami kind of rates, because we have high rates of family fragility in the white community, black community, Hispanic community. These are the things we have to talk about. Yes, we need to audit programs, but we have to acknowledge that policy can only go so far.
Exactly.
We have to revitalize the key institutions, family, religion, education, and entrepreneurship.
So as we look at those numbers from the Wall Street Journal, again, if you're looking at just those that felt it was very important to them, that it gives you a really interesting look and could be a cause for some pretty deep depression. But as always, we have to go underneath the numbers and look at the things in a complete perspective, get the full range. Elizabeth Nolan Brown did that at Reason.com today, talking about the majority of Americans still see hard work, tolerance, religion, patriotism as important American values. And so while the extremes of the polling seem to show there have been some stark changes in terms of how we view some of those crucial institutions and those critical values, but if you really look at the polling data, let's look at it this way. So 94% of Americans still say hard work is very or somewhat important. So 94%. So everyone is pretty much saying, yeah, hard work is at least somewhat important, and it's probably very important. The percentage who say tolerance for others is very important did shrink. It definitely went down, those who think it's very important. But 90% of Americans still say that it's very or somewhat important to have tolerance as a value for the citizens of this country. America is still plenty patriotic as well. According to the poll, 73% say patriotism is very or somewhat important. So you have to look at the complete set of the data in order to really get an understanding of where we are. So I'm one of those who I don't think all is lost in this country. I do worry at the trends that are undermining our commitment to those values and those principles that founded the nation and have caused us to flourish. We're not perfect as a country. I don't think anyone's trying to say that. And I don't think patriotism has anything to do with a kind of nationalism that is excluding of others. or is a top-down authoritarian approach to anything, or that we are better than, I think it's a different thing than that. I think the kind of patriotism that President Zelensky has really fostered in Ukraine, where he has brought together all the diversity and united it around a common focus of preservation of the country, is what has been really powerful. So we're going to continue to look at this. This is a conversation we'll stay with all week this week of, yes, some of the numbers say that patriotism has slid, commitment and importance of religion in our lives, tolerance, all of those things have taken somewhat of a hit. But we have to remember the things that we ignore or forget, our children may not know. That's what I worry about. And what our children don't know, our grandchildren are never going to possess. That's what's under the numbers, and that's where we all have to begin the conversation.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Well, simple question. Mr. President, why can't we talk? Call me. Now, there's obviously a number of things going along, most of them political, sadly. And when it comes to the debt ceiling, obviously action has to be taken on that. We also have mounting debt and deficit spending that continues to plague the country, fuels inflation, hurts the poor and the most vulnerable among us the most. And so can we just talk? Can we just get together? So I want to get to where we are in this conversation and what needs to be included in this conversation. And yes, there's some politics. Both sides are playing with this. But the result still needs to be the same. We need to get President Biden and we need to get Speaker McCarthy in the room, because that is where it will happen. So Speaker McCarthy spoke to reporters this morning about the lack of negotiations from the president on the debt ceiling.
Well, 2 months ago, I sat down with the president to negotiate a debt ceiling. The president has misled the members of Congress, misled the American public that he was going to negotiate. He hasn't done that. I don't know what he's afraid of in the process. If he thinks you just have to raise the debt ceiling, there's not votes in the House to do that. There's not votes in the Senate to do that. If that's the case, Schumer sends one of those.
So really interesting coming out of the Speaker's office. The Speaker had sent a letter to President Biden saying, hey, the ball's in your court. The clock is ticking. You're on the clock, so to speak. We need to get together. And he's waiting to hear from the president when his schedule might open up. Now, the Speaker went on to say that it's important for the president and Republicans to be in the same room discussing the debt ceiling and not waiting until the last minute.
I think the responsible thing to do is to get into the room. The Republicans have worked on a plan. We believe in limit, save, and grow. Limit our spending. Even Joe Manchin agrees with this, outlaying spending going forward. I think there's a way that we can get this done early, which would help the economy, instead of the brinkmanship the president is trying to play.
Now, to be very fair and very clear, the president isn't the only one who plays the brinksmanship game. Both sides love to play brinksmanship. It's how you get extra things in your bill. It's how you get decisions done that otherwise wouldn't have been done, with a whole host of things that, so to speak, grease the skids to make it possible. And it always means more spending and bigger problems for the American people. So on one hand, I think Kevin McCarthy is right to say, look, let's get in the room and let's actually negotiate. let's not start by saying we won't negotiate. Let's start by saying let's negotiate. Let's have a conversation. And obviously there's two different things that need to be dealt with. The debt ceiling has to be dealt with. Absolutely. But if you're that deep in debt, if you're in that much financial trouble, surely you ought to be having a conversation about how do we stop this madness. We are at the bottom of the proverbial hole, and we should stop digging. So let's set the shovels down, and let's get in the same room. Now, Speaker McCarthy went on to say this isn't about the budget, and Republicans are ready to talk about the debt ceiling.
Well, the budget has nothing to do with the debt ceiling. So if you want to talk about budget, we could talk about budget. But if you're talking about the debt ceiling, I could pass the budget tomorrow, but that doesn't do anything to raise the debt ceiling. We have $4 trillion in savings for the president to sit down and negotiate with. The problem with the budget is the president was late, and we met more than a month before he ever produced his budget. So if you want to talk budget, we could do budget every day. But we're talking about debt ceiling. Let's get the debt ceiling done and stop playing games.
So this is the interesting thing. Both sides have been playing the game with the debt ceiling and the budget. And both, when it has been convenient for them, have muddied the water with budget negotiations, cut negotiations, and the debt ceiling. The speaker was right, and the president has been right on this, that they're separate things. But both sides muddy the waters and pull them back together and conflate them into one thing when it serves their purposes politically. And that's where both sides need to stop playing games. And they do need to get in the room where it happens and be in the room and stay in the room until they get it done. And I think they ought to do both. Because we do need to deal with the budget and we do need to deal with the debt ceiling. But let's not make this one more Washington, D.C. fake fight and false choice. Because that ends up hurting all of us. Because what we end up doing is both sides end up just weaponizing whatever the other side has said. Now, the president this week has been on the attack, attacking Republicans for positions on Social Security, including the potential of raising the retirement age. Now, CNN had a very interesting report today, a bit of a surprise coming out of CNN, that they actually showed President Biden back in 1987. In 1987, this was President Biden talking about a reasonable and rational approach to Social Security.
The year 2010, we are going to change the retirement age for Social Security. You cannot retire at age 65. You have to be 65 years and 3 months old. In the year 2012, 65 years and 6 months. In the year, literally, raise incrementally the retirement age till you reach a retirement age between 68 and 70.
Okay. Now, the president has been beating up Republicans for suggesting any changes to retirement age. And clearly, he's been down this path. He's thought this through. But the question then is, why are we beating each other up for positions that we all seem to think are the same? And Republicans have done the same thing to the president on a number of issues. So it's really interesting. CNN explained the path of how President Biden came to change his position when it comes to changing the retirement age.
Biden is attacking, and the White House are attacking Republicans for positions that he once held on Social Security. We just heard that clip where he talked about wanting to raise the retirement age in the 1980s. That's something he said repeatedly, but it actually goes beyond that. Take, for instance, his attacks on Rick Scott and this sunset legislation. Now, sunsetting basically means that a program will get authorized for something like 4 years, and then if it's not reauthorized, they don't fund it anymore. That's hence where the term sunset comes from. Now, Biden introduced a bill in 1975 that did the exact same thing. It sunset all federal legislation without exemptions for Social Security and Medicare. And what's interesting about this is Biden's bill to do this, this sunset legislation, was the first ever of its kind. We just saw on the screen where he was basically boasting about how he sort of almost invented this concept of sunsetting at the federal level.
Now, I get it. People change positions over time. That's not a problem. I don't have an issue with that. But I do have an issue when we just do it when it's convenient, when it's a way to beat up political opponents as opposed to having policy discussions. And that is the problem. So whether it's Republicans attacking the president, whether it's president attacking Republicans, just get in the room. Just say, you know what, we're gonna sit down and we're going to have this conversation. The White House has said it's time for Republicans to stop playing games. Republicans have said it's time for the president to get serious, to have a meeting and stop playing games. And sadly, both sides are reaping the rewards with campaign cash, fundraising dollars for playing games. We pay athletes millions and millions of dollars to play games. We do not elect people to go to Washington, D.C. to play games. We send them there to solve difficult, complex problems. And you don't solve difficult, complex problems by playing games. And it's time for both sides to get in the room. We do need a budget. We do need to talk about cuts to spending, because that is going to cripple the economy and hurt our children and grandchildren. We do need to have serious conversations about changing the course that we're going there. And we have to raise the debt ceiling. We have to do all of those things. And we can do all of those things if both sides decide to quit playing games. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more coming up on Inside Sources. We're going to take a look at the role of the chief of staff coming up next. This is an interesting one. You got to listen to this. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, I got a little bit of a chuckle just reading the headline from Adam Cankren's Politico piece, which is just epic. Jeff Zients discovers the thanklessness of the White House chief of staff gig. As a former Senate chief of staff, I think I get a very small window into what I think has to be the most difficult job in Washington, D.C. It's a 24/7 job to be the White House chief of staff. It is 24/7, and it's part trains on time, part strategist, part cruise director, part junior high counselor and interventionist, therapist and confidant, and part-time cat herder. And I'm sure there's a few more that happen between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. But Adam, we appreciate you joining us. This is a great piece. And obviously with the new White House chief of staff, there's growing pains and some little settling that has to take place. But thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. And I think you described the job about as accurately as I've heard anybody ever do it.
Well, let's jump in there and some of the things that you noted in your piece. Obviously, whenever there's a change, especially with the chief of staff role, there's always going to be rumblings and grumblings and someone's not going to like this or someone's going to feel cheated out of their time with the boss. But what are some of the things that Jeff Zients is experiencing as he settles into that new role?
Yeah, exactly. And this is particularly difficult because he's replacing Ron Klain, right, who is kind of a singular personality in his ability to kind of manage everything and his desire to be involved in everything, not to mention the fact that he did the job for 2 years, longer than any other Democratic chief of staff. So you have Jeff Zients here coming in as somebody who, one, has not been in the Biden orbit for decades, as some other aides have been, senior aides have been, and also kind of coming in this transitionary period where we're on the cusp of a potential reelection, but not quite there, you know, trying to deal with a divided Congress. And the main questions here for Jeff Zients are, one, whether he has the political instincts, having not come from a Hill or administration background, to navigate all of this, to navigate everything going on inside and outside the building. And then secondly, whether he has the relationships on Capitol Hill. You know, he has not done any stint as a lawmaker or as an aide on the Hill, has not really been relied upon to be that connective tissue there. But when you're the chief of staff, you're going to be the one in the negotiations, especially when we're dealing with the Republican House. So those are the two main issues, the two main things that people have been watching very closely to see how he does.
Yeah, and so interesting. And I'm glad you mentioned Ron Klain, because he is such a unique individual and so hands-on in every decision and everything. And Jeff Zients is much more a CEO kind of background, business background, in terms of delegation and being efficient and effective and who's responsible for what. I want to get to this point that you made about Capitol Hill and the connective tissue that the chief of staff often is for that. And I know this has been one area where lawmakers have either felt a little caught flat-footed or maybe not communicated with or brought into the circle. Give us a sense of that.
Yeah, and so this is one of those kind of things where it's, you know, it's a difference of styles, right? When Ron Klain was there, a lot of lawmakers would just kind of email or text or call him directly when they had a question or they wanted to understand the administration's thinking. Really a unique way of operating simply because Ron Klain knew the Hill.
Yeah.
And he was up emailing and texting at seemingly all hours. Whereas with Jeff Zients, to your point, is very much the kind of CEO management consulting model, the background that he comes from, where his attitude, as described to us, is, you know, I have the best people in the world who can handle ledger fairs, who can handle engagement with outside groups. Why would I, you know, take the front row of that when there are people who can manage that and then keep me in the loop? And so it has been jarring, especially for lawmakers who expected that direct access to continue, to adjust to this new style. And also it's kind of coincided with some controversial decisions out of the White House. One, the approval of this Willow drilling project in Alaska, which was kind of a reversal, upset progressives. There was also an incident over President Biden's support for a D.C. Crime overhaul bill, where lawmakers ended up feeling like he kind of flip-flopped and left them out to dry on what was a politically tough vote. So all of those things kind of coming together at the same time has kind of created this, I guess, nervousness or this feeling that, hey, on lawmakers' side, things are changing very quickly and they're struggling to kind of keep up with what's going on in the West Wing.
Yeah, and I think that it's been a challenge for the West Wing overall over the past 2 years in terms of that communication and decision-making. They seem to be a little slower on the uptake or the deliberative process. I think the president likes to sit on things or weigh things a little bit more as they go through. And it will be interesting to see if Jeff Zients, again, with more of a business background, of will he be able to accelerate kind of that turnover process of observing, of acting and, or deciding and then communicating those so they can take action on them. Any sense from some of the insiders in the West Wing in terms of how that part of the program is rolling?
Yeah, it's kind of a wait and see. I mean, some folks we talked to actually really liked the differences, the changes that have been made, because they feel like procedurally things are more structured, right? Meetings are shorter. They tend to be shorter. They tend to be more efficient. If you submit, you know, there's a process now for if you have something you need to raise the chief of staff level, you can submit a memo. You know you're going to get a response back, you know, in a certain regimented way. And that, I think, appeals to some folks who felt like under Ron Klain, things were just kind of a little too informal, a little too freewheeling because he had his fingers in everything. On the other hand, I think there are some folks who, at least early on here, missed that because they felt like it was a more, you know, casual atmosphere where they could just kind of work across teams and figure things out on the fly. So like any workplace, and the White House just happens to be a more famous workplace, there's certainly some growing pains in getting used to the management and the leadership style that we're going to have here going forward.
Yeah, you also mentioned the pending campaign ramp up, and that's one that, again, I think is going to be very interesting for Jeff Zients to navigate. But I also wonder if some of these disciplines that he's putting in place actually won't help the administration in dealing with both the rigors of the campaign while still doing the real job, which is governing.
Yeah, it is really an open question of who exactly is going to do what and how that's going to interact. So you have other senior aides who are maybe more politically experienced. You have Anita Dunn and Steve Ricchetti as examples who really have been political operatives now for decades, right, and are in that world. And you also have the question of how much of the campaign is going to be run out of the White House versus the official campaign apparatus and how that interacts. And these are always tricky things for a White House that's on the cusp of kind of a reelection bid here. Even more difficult in this case because you're having to contend with a Republican House majority. You're having to contend with some of these kind of looming crises, debt ceiling coming up, kind of economic uncertainty around the banking sector. So a lot of it is going to be figuring out on the fly kind of how all of this fits together. And back to your point, you know, how to make sure and maximize the communication that's going back and forth between Democrats.
Yeah. Anything else under the surface that you're watching as this new operation inside of the White House with the new chief of staff is playing out?
Well, one of the other aspects that we always keep a close eye on is what ripple effects there are in the broader administration, so the various cabinet departments. You always want to see, because that kind of filters down, and especially in this White House, where a lot of the decision-making up until now has been concentrated among a few aides in Biden's inner circle. And so a lot of the decisions are made there. It's going to be interesting now with this more of a hierarchical CEO approach, whether cabinet departments get a little bit more free rein to pursue their different priorities.
Yeah, so important. Great stuff. Great piece in Politico. And we really appreciate you carving out some time for us today, Adam. And again, Adam Cankren is the White House correspondent for Politico. And it's a great piece on something that I hold near and dear. I may have to pull out. I once wrote for all of my chief of staff colleagues across the political spectrum a version of the old Paul Harvey, So God Made a Farmer, but it was So God Made a Chief of Staff. And we may have to come back to that. But Adam, your piece is fantastic in Politico. Great insight into Jeff Zients. And he has a real tall order and some tricky windows to navigate. But it'll be interesting to see if his discipline and business approach can actually carry the day. But Adam, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. We will step aside for a quick commercial break. We may have to dust off the So God Made a Chief of Staff. I think it is. He got it right. It is a thankless job in Washington, and it is 24/7, nonstop, relentless. So our best to Jeff Zients. Again, I don't care what your politics are. Pray for the Chief of Staff. All right. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Well, as most of you know, I struggle with this thing called holy envy. I learned so much from so many different religious practices and have things that I just really love about each of them. And of course, last week began the month of Ramadan. It's an important month in the Muslim community. It's one of reflection and fasting and prayer and community, which is so important. And just love seeing a headline from our friend Holly Richardson, a columnist and editor of Utah Policy for the Deseret News, called Ramadan Has Become Personal for This Christian Mom. And Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Boyd.
So as I look at it, one of my favorite quotes about Ramadan is that Ramadan, this month of Ramadan, is one of the doors of mercy flung wide open as an opportunity for soul cleansing, that Ramadan is a month whose beginning is mercy, whose middle is forgiveness, and whose end is freedom. Give us a little bit of the backstory of what you're experiencing in your home this season of Ramadan.
Well, we, like many parents, have adult children living with us right now. And one of those is our daughter and her husband, Hassan, who is a Muslim man, and they met and married in Utah, and they're expecting their first baby, but they're in our home right now. And he's observing Ramadan, which is the fasting part of it is from sunrise to sundown for a month, as you mentioned. And before it even started, I asked him if there was anything we could do to make it easier for him. And he said there wasn't, but I've tried to be careful not to cook food with strong smells during the daylight hours when he's around, but you know, it's hard, but he really has been great and gracious to share iftar, breaking the fast with us at the end of the day. And right now sunset is about 7:48 PM. So he's eating late and then he's eating again like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Mm. And so as you've watched him go through that, as you've experienced that in your own home, what are some of the things that have stood out to you as that has gone forward?
I think really he's been really open with us with being able to share, you know, the conversation about what Ramadan means. And I have found it interesting that he has felt a lot more drawn to observing Ramadan completely now that they're expecting their first baby. So they've been together for 3 Ramadans, and this is the first one where every single day he is saying prayers and he's fasting, and it really has something to do with the baby that's coming, and that is just really tender to me.
Oh, I love that. That's so powerful. We know that part of the month of Ramadan, from some of my friends that have observed and have taught me about some of those things. It's really a period of intense introspection, and that, that Muslims are to avoid conflict and really weigh their words and deeds carefully. Charity, of course, is mandatory for all Muslims year-round, but they're supposed to have kind of an increase, increase their good deeds and that capacity during Ramadan.
Yeah, and I see that not only with him, but with some of our other Muslim friends. So we went and celebrated an interfaith iftar on Sunday, and we're going to another unity iftar on Saturday. And what we see is really this heartfelt desire to be better, right? To I see it sometimes with my Catholic friends as well, right, who take Lent and say, this is an opportunity for me to try and really focus on what's spiritual and important to me. We do it sometimes as other Christian communities within, you know, around Easter. And how can we be better? And the idea that you're going to spend a whole month looking at how you can be kinder and how you can forgive. And, you know, not everybody is thrilled that my daughter married a Muslim man, but he holds no animosity towards anyone else. And I mean, I think that's just a really great example also.
Oh, I love that. Give me just a little sense from your experience this last week attending an iftar with the Utah Muslim Civic League.
Mm-hmm. So last week's was actually with a mosque in Riverton, let's see, West Jordan, and a local LDS community. So it was a shared interfaith one. And what they did is they had the LDS bishop and the imam both give thoughts. They showed us around the mosque. They had prayer. And then we were able to share a meal together after sundown. And I think, again, the idea of we want to know more about our brothers and sisters. We all worship a God who believes that we are brothers and sisters. I think that that is a good reminder for all of us when we're looking about, well, they might be different than me. Well, but they believe in a God that loves all of his children. And I think that that applies to all of us.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And there's been so many pieces of data that have been delivered lately talking about when we don't know people of another faith, we tend to judge them harshly or to think ill of them. What has this experience done to you to open your eyes in terms of Islam?
Well, I started learning more about Islam when I started doing international humanitarian work. A lot of the refugees that we've worked with have been Muslim. And so that really opened my eyes. How do you observe Ramadan in a refugee camp, right? Mm. It's very difficult, but people do it anyway. And this idea, right, that we can live together in harmony and peace, like that had already been a hope of mine. But now I have a son-in-law, and it's even more personal. You might find this interesting. Within an hour of my article being published, I got an email to my work email saying, well, basically he's fooled you. It's nice that you have charity for him, but this isn't a religion. This is a violent movement, right? A violent political movement. And I'm like, this is a religion of peace with over 2 billion members. And to have, there are definitely extremists within that religion, but most members are kind and loving people, and they do want to promote peace. And bless them, right? Like, I can barely fast for 24 hours once a month.
it is. And the more we know, the more we understand, the more we come to see the value in each. And again, I think that's where that holy envy actually begins, as we just start to really appreciate what everyone brings to the table. Dr. Holly Richardson's columnist and editor of Utah Policy for the Deseret News. And Holly, as always, we appreciate you weighing in and sharing some great thoughts with us.
Thanks for having me, Boyd, as always.
All right. It's so important as we're going through Ramadan. And I'm going to go back to where I began this segment because I think this month, having a month set aside, one that is definitely physically and emotionally taxing, as Holly pointed out, you know, fasting from sunrise to sunset every day. Additional time in prayer, time with loved ones and family and community, so important. But that real focus on avoiding conflict, weighing your words, weighing your deeds really carefully, I think it is such a beautiful, powerful thing. And while charity is always mandatory for Muslims year round. They're supposed to increase their good deeds during Ramadan. And so, again, Ramadan is one of the doors of mercy flung wide open as an opportunity for soul cleansing. I love that approach to the month. And Ramadan is the month whose beginning is mercy, whose middle is forgiveness, and whose end is freedom. That's a powerful thing and something we all can have a little holy envy for as we go through the month of Ramadan. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We will step aside for some top-of-the-hour news. Don't go anywhere. When we come back, Representative Chris Stewart will join us on the line from Washington, D.C. We'll talk about President Biden's latest executive order on spyware. Stay with us. More to come on Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
This week, President Joe Biden signed a long-awaited executive order prohibiting the use of commercial spyware, and the timing of it couldn't have been more significant. The headlines, of course, because it was also reported this week that 50 U.S. government employees were hacked by commercial spyware overseas. So what will change as this executive order goes into effect, and more importantly, what questions still need to be answered beyond the headlines? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
Someone who knows their way around these issues in a very unique way, Congressman Chris Stewart, representative of Utah's 2nd Congressional District, has stepped out of a committee hearing to come join us today. Congressman, thanks for making time. I know it's a busy day for you back there in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, and give us a sense. What does this executive order the president has signed actually do?
Well, let me back up, if I could, Boyd, if you'll allow it, and that is to talk about the power of some of these spy programs. I mean, the ability to surveil. If these are implemented on your phone, and it can be done as easily as one click, as people know, one click, then after that, they have complete, utter access to your phone. In other words, they see everything that you type, whether it's text, whether it's email. They see and read and have the ability to monitor every conversation you have, every response to your email. They can turn on your microphone and listen to you without you knowing it, by the way. You had no idea that they turned on the microphone. They can turn on your camera and see what the surroundings around you. And once again, your camera doesn't come up on your screen. You don't know your camera is turned on. So when they say, this is spyware, I mean, this is incredibly powerful software that essentially turns your phone into the perfect spy machine. Well, the problem is twofold. Number one, now to your question, number one is we don't want foreign states or terrorist organizations to have access to this software. And unfortunately, the truth is, as many of them do, which you indicated, Boyd, by the fact you pointed out, the same government employees have been penetrated with the software. The other thing is we don't want our own government to be using this software against U.S. citizens without, the knowledge and without the acquiescence of the federal courts, as they should have. And that's where we've been our highest concerns is the fact that the FBI had access to spyware and was using it, they said, just to evaluate it. But that made some of us very, very concerned with the history there that over the last 5 or 6 years that I think many people are familiar with and share those concerns.
Yeah, that testing it out, so to speak, is very concerning because you can learn a lot in that whole process. And one of the things that you mentioned, Congressman, that I think is so important, that is the use of the courts, if that kind of surveillance is going to happen, whether it's using this spyware or any other kind of surveillance, that there has to be a proper process so that the government can't target just good, upstanding American citizens.
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen again over the last 5 to 6 years, going back to Carter Page, who had a FISA application, which is the process where the FBI or other intelligence agencies goes to the courts and they say, we need to have access to personal information regarding this U.S. citizen who we think is acting as a foreign agent. And that's the difference here. It's not that we think they're involved with crime or criminal activity. It's they're acting as a foreign agent. And the problem was, this isn't a political opinion. This is just a known fact now. The FBI lied to the FISA courts, and they absolutely deceived them in a number of cases, not just one, but in a number of cases. And then knowing that that happens from time to time, and it frankly happens a surprisingly often number of times, but then combine that with the ability to not just, you know, wiretap your phone using an old term that still applies, but actually to embed a piece of equipment like we've already described here, and not just listening to your phone calls, but to be able to read your text, read your emails, turn on your microphone, et cetera. Again, for many of us, that's just kind of a hard red line. The U.S. government cannot implement that type of technology, and we shouldn't ever allow them to.
Yeah, well, you have a really unique perspective and unique perch on this one in the House Intelligence Committee. You were part of a group that signed a letter last year calling on the administration to take some stronger action against spyware. Is what the president has done by executive order, is it enough? Does Congress need to pick up the baton on part of this? What does that look like moving forward?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm glad the president did this. I wished he would have done it obvious earlier. And it's not just last year when we sent the letter. We've been working with the administration since, you know, probably about the first month of the administration when this became aware of this as a potential threat, that we started working with the administration to try to get them to do it. So it took us, you know, almost 2 years to convince them. But, you know, I'm glad and I'm grateful that they have. But the second thing, Boyd, that goes along with this, because once again, that's not the only thing that we're concerned about, there's going to be a concerted effort in this fall in Congress, because your question was, is there things that Congress can do? And the answer is, yeah, absolutely there is. And as we look at reauthorizing what we call 702 or FISA, which is, again, these tools that the agencies and the FBI have in order to surveil non-U.S. citizens overseas, but sometimes that spills over to U.S. citizens here in the U.S., there's got to be significant reforms in that, because again and again, we see things that that violate constitutional rights, violate privacy. Sometimes it sincerely and genuinely is just an accident. I mean, we didn't actually mean to gain this access, and we blacked it all out and we put it aside. But in some cases, it has been malicious in their intent. And that FISA reform this fall, in conjunction with other efforts like the president's executive order, all of that's critical to assure American people, look, your own government isn't spying on you. Your own government can't spy on you. That's the goal we need to be working towards. And we're just not there yet.
Yeah. And so what is it from the administration standpoint? What else should the administration be doing at this point in terms of beefing that up or making that stronger?
Well, I mean, one of them is they just got it. And I know this is going to sound overly partisan, and I don't mean it to, but it's just the truth as I see it. And that is, you've got to put directors and, you know, senior executives in position who share the same concerns that you and I do, and a lot of your listeners do, about the government doesn't have the right to violate my own privacy or constitutional rights. And we've seen examples too often under current Department of Justice, Attorney General Garland and others who they're just simply not as concerned about that as we are. And I'll give you a really easy example that's in the public realm, so I can discuss it. But, you know, the way they weaponize their efforts against parents who were just concerned about teachers and what was being taught in schools. And these parents weren't terrorists. I mean, for heaven's sakes, there's just no possible plausible case you could make these people actually pose any threat. Yet they were treated as terrorists. And they're identified as terrorists in FBI database. And I mean, if you ask what one more we can do, the answer to that is to provide leadership that wouldn't weaponize the federal government against innocent Americans. And there's example after example of that now, and it's incredibly distressing to watch and to see. And it's such a fundamental breakdown in the way our government should treat their citizens as if they lord over us, and we're their subjects. I mean, that's one of the keys to this, Boyd, is leadership that values the same things that you and I value. We're talking about here.
Yeah, so important. And that ability of the government to, as you said, either weaponize or to target U.S. citizens using some of these things is such a crucial conversation. And we look forward to continuing to watch your influence in this particular space, both in the House Intelligence Committee, but in a host of other places and spaces that you're leading and working and navigating with people across the political spectrum. And Congressman, again, we know you stepped out of a hearing to join us today. We appreciate your perspective as always, and we look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's Congressman Chris Stewart. Again, he's on the House Intelligence Committee, and this is crucial. I mean, just listening to him describe what that spyware can do on your phone, a single click, and suddenly they've got access to everything you type in a text, in an email. Every site you visit, they can turn on your microphone, your camera. That's some pretty powerful stuff. And so, again, we applaud the president for signing that executive order. I think it's got to go further. I think we have to get Congress to make sure they're weighing in and really galvanizing and codifying some of these things so we can protect the American people across the political spectrum. Every citizen deserves to be protected from being targeted by their own government.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you as always. Of course, we've been keeping an eye on France. They've been enduring massive public demonstrations and riots against the current government, bringing the country to a pretty significant halt. The reason? The French government has pushed through this pension reform that would raise the retirement age in an effort to save the country's retirement funds. If this sounds like preview of coming attraction, I don't know. The French are pretty good at protesting and just a fascinating thing. And so to break that down and help us understand all of that, we turn to one of our great inside sources, Jay Evenson, of course, senior editorial columnist at the Deseret News. And you started, Jay, by saying that the garbage is piling up. And is this really what happens here in the U.S. if we don't fix Social Security?
You know, Boyd, and thank you for having me today. It's hard to imagine a more slow-moving disaster than what's happening to Social Security. I mean, we've known about this for decades, that when the baby boomers hit retirement, Social Security and Medicare would both be in trouble because you have far more retirees than you have workers to support them. And now so the trustees themselves, Social Security trustees, have said we're looking at about 2030. I think they said 2033. It might have been 2034 before this becomes a real issue, before the trust fund runs dry and cuts are being forced upon us. The Congressional Budget Office came a couple of months ago and said, you know, because of the inflation that we've been having, that really ought to be moved up to 2032. So now it's within the 10-year budget cycles for the U.S. government, and the president came out with his budget proposal, and it included nothing about Social Security. So you had a round of some, back and forth in Washington over this. But we really have got to come to terms with this because it's a lot easier to fix today than it will be in 2032.
Yeah, if you want to talk about some draconian cuts, that is what will happen in 2032 if nothing happens. And you pointed out the president and his new budget has about $3.2 trillion in new taxes, but none of those go towards Social Security, keeping that solvent. We played a clip earlier in the show, Jay, from President Biden, then Senator Biden, from back in 1987, and he was proposing then to raise the retirement age to 70 by 2010, so more than a decade ago. So I started to think, man, I wonder what would have happened in the streets of France if they had increased the retirement age by 10 a decade ago. But we do have to get to this conversation one way or the other.
Well, we do. And the problem is that both sides, but I think particularly Democrats right now, are weaponizing this and using it as a campaign issue, trying to say that, oh, Republicans want to cut. And you talk about raising the retirement age. A lot of them are arguing that raising the retirement age would be the equivalent of a cut, which I think is first of all, we have to remember 1983, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill got together and saved Social Security for that generation.
Yeah.
One of the things that they did was agree to gradually raise the retirement age from 65 to 67. Now, I was brand new in the workforce back then, and my official retirement age is 66 and 10 months because of that. It's a phased-in thing to the year 2027. I have to honestly confess to you, I'm glad Senator Biden didn't get that increase to 70.
That's right.
Because I don't want to work that long. But you know what's interesting is the University of Maryland's Program for Public Consultation did a study a year ago, and they polled Republicans and Democrats, and they found a number of ways, a number of changes to Social Security that has huge buy-in from both parties. And this would be a great starting point for the discussion. And for example, raising the cap on the payroll tax. Most people don't realize this. Any income over $147,000 a year is not taxed for Social Security. Well, why not raise that to $400,000 a year? And in the polls, 79% of Republicans and 88% of Democrats agreed that they would support that. That would eliminate 61% of the shortfall. Then there's a question of raising the payroll tax itself from 6.2% to 6.5%. Reagan and O'Neill did that back in 83 as well. This has 70% support of Republicans, 78% support of Democrats. And then there's a question of whether high-earning retirees ought to get the full benefits of Social Security. Again, that has huge buy-in on both parties. And then when you come to what's happening in France, why not raise the retirement age to 68? That also has about three-quarters percent support from both Republicans and Democrats. So there are areas where we can agree upon and make changes today that will keep us from having a crisis 8 years from now.
And I think that's so crucial, Jay, that you talk about that weaponization of, you know, anyone who puts any idea out there just gets whacked over the head with it. Of the, you know, they're pushing grandma off the cliff, or it's, you know, driving us into socialism or whatever it might be. And that fake fight and false choice, where again, the overwhelming majority say, you know what, we are willing to do this. We had Yuval Levin on last week, and when he talked about Social Security in the context of a gratitude payment, because really it's a pay from current workers to the former workers who did all the things to create the great society and the world that we live in now. And so it really is a gratitude thing going back. And surely we can figure out how to do that and to really find that interconnected component. Because if we crush the young workers trying to keep it solvent, that's not going to help it either. Nor are we going to push grandma off the cliff, because we're going to show that gratitude. But it seems to me, as you pointed out, there's plenty of alignment and agreement if we could just get the politicians and the politics out of the way.
Right. And neither party wants to cut or do away with Social Security. I love that argument of one generation looking out for another and looking back and forth. I think that brings the nation together. That's unity. And certainly on a program as popular as Social Security, and we have to be honest about it, this is not supposed to pay for, it's never been supposed to pay for your entire retirement. But we also have to be honest and look at the statistics, and about 40% of retired Americans rely on Social Security for most, if not all, of their income. Mm. So it's a very important program. We're going to have to be paying for it one way or another. If we didn't have it, we'd have a lot of other social welfare problems to deal with. We need to come together. We need to realize that this benefits everybody, that we're all on board. We all agree we need to fix Social Security. Let's do it now before it becomes a crisis. And the ones being hit over the head in 2032 will be the politicians who failed to come to terms with this when it would have been easier.
Yeah, no question about it. Jay Evenson, senior editorial columnist at the Deseret News, always provides us the great in-depth background and deep dive information and insight on what's happening. And we started with garbage in France, and we better be careful, because that might be dumped on our heads in 2032 if we're not careful. Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
so important. This is one of those conversations. As Jay pointed out, there is such overwhelming agreement on how we fix this, and that we can fix this, and that we're willing to fix this. And Americans overwhelmingly are even willing to pay to fix it. And yet the politicians more interested in scoring political points than solving the American people's problems and issues is the problem. And that's garbage, France-level garbage. But we will be in the same place in just a few years if we don't address it, and if those we've elected and sent back to Congress don't have the courage and political will to make it happen. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom-of-the-hour news. Coming up, there's a fascinating new study released that takes a serious look at the driving forces behind growing work rate disparities in our country. You don't want to miss this conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Really grateful to have back on the program Nicholas Eberstadt, who holds the Wendt Chair of Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute, and just has a great deep dive piece in national affairs, The Geography of Work. And we've talked a lot about the growing numbers of American adults who've dropped out of the workforce, or those who just seem to not be coming back even post-pandemic. And Nicholas, this is a great deep dive, but for our listeners, just give us kind of a broad sense in terms of where we are in terms of the workforce, and do we really have a work crisis? And if so, what are some of the underlying things we're seeing there?
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me back, Boyd. I think everybody knows we've got a work crisis in America, because anywhere you travel, there are employers who are practically begging people to submit job applications. We've got this unprecedented, peculiar peacetime labor shortage. That doesn't happen in market economies usually, right? Wow. We've been having this flight from work for prime age men that's been underway for two generations now. In our post-pandemic era, there's also a new face to the flight from work, with some of our older men and women, I think prematurely, I would say, retiring from the labor force, maybe unsustainably so. The upshot is that we're about 4 million men and women short in our workforce of where we thought we'd be on pre-pandemic trends, which is almost exactly the increase in the unfilled jobs in post-pandemic America. So that's the overall picture for the nation. Well, this study that I did with my colleague Peter Van Ness was trying to make a pretty simple point, which is that when we listen to the jobs reports, when we get unemployment statistics, these are national averages, but we have a whole lot of variation within the United States. And that big variation in employment rates and labor force participation, we just don't usually look at that. A lot of the clues, I think, as to what's gone wrong with work in America is at the local level, not at the national level. So we should be kind of looking at more of this part of the mystery.
Yeah, and I love that. And I love that that's part of why this work is so important. We always talk about getting beyond the headlines and beyond just those top line numbers. You actually pointed out in this piece that obviously there's been a lot of studies about the workforce participation. But you talk about the fact that it's been kind of surfacey, and we've created a lot of blind spots among scholars and policymakers. And you said one of those is kind of the geography of it. So dig into that a little bit for us.
Yeah. Well, if you start to scratch away from the surface, if you start to look at what's happening in different localities all across the nation, we do not have a one-size-fits-all labor problem in the United States. We have huge variations in work rate and employment rates and labor force participation rates from one end of the country to the next. But it's not the way that it used to be in the past. You know, it's not like just a depressed Appalachia or an old South. We have enormous variations even within the same state, even going down the road an hour from one place to another. And that's kind of a surprise, because that's not what was supposed to happen with market economics and a, you know, kind of a fluid labor force where people could be moving in search of opportunity. I mean, I'll give you one national example. There's a gap of over 50 percentage points between, in terms of workforce participation for the adult population, between Fargo, North Dakota, and the Villages, Florida, a 50 percentage point difference. I mean, that's just astonishing. Now, there's part of this, a little bit of a trick to what I just showed you, because the Villages is a you know, retirement community, and, you know, and North Dakota's in the middle still of a fracking boom. But if you do apples to apples, if you just look at people in the, let's say, in the 25 to 54 year old so-called prime working age range, you can still find a gap of almost 20 percentage points between some metropolitan areas and others in the United States. So a lot of what has gone wrong is seen in these big variations, because we argue in this study that we didn't used to have such big variations. And part of what's happened as we have gone down is we've gotten these bigger gaps in the country.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, the geography of that. So let's kind of go into some of the locale kind of things in terms of those differences. You said sometimes you're just going an hour down the road and you're experiencing these vast gaps. Is that a policy issue? Is that just a geography issue? What is it that you're seeing there?
We have stumbled onto something that I don't think my co-author and I can entirely explain. We can describe it. I don't know that we can explain it. What we are seeing, for one thing, is that in places like California and places like Florida, there are 20 percentage point plus differences in labor force participation for pretty big places within the same state. And most of these gaps in the United States today aren't regional. They're within particular states. You know, three quarters of these disparities that we're talking about are found within state borders. One of the things that begs is, how much state policy do you have? Do you have a kind of like a business climate for a state? And if so, you know, how do you end up with such big differences within states? That's something I can't answer for you yet. What I can tell you is that our economists and policy researchers, and I very much include myself in this, are kind of trained implicitly to think that the national averages that they see are kind of almost like iron laws. So that if you see that black labor force participation rates are lower than white labor force participation rates, you think this has just got to be the same everywhere in the country. Well, it's not.
Right.
I mean, you go to a place like Charlottesville, Virginia, and you find that the African-American labor force participation rate is higher than the white. Does anybody ask about that? No. Is there any curiosity about why this is the case? And maybe does this tell us something about how rates can be raised? No. But in looking at the different localities across the United States, I think we're going to find the clues for how to turn some of this problem around.
I love that. And that's where we have to get. One, we got to stay curious. We have to get past the sweeping generalities of a lot of these. And then I love this idea of really doing the deep dive at the local levels there, where, as you said, I think we can find a lot of the clues in terms of what could impact those work rates and the participation rates in the workforce. Great stuff. Just real quickly before I let you go, Nicholas, one thing that we should be thinking about that we're not even talking about when it comes to work.
We should be looking at the story of communities all across the country and listening to local people. That's something that our policymakers and our social scientists aren't so good at, I'm afraid. If we had a better journalistic core, if some of your comrades were a little bit more curious, as you are, we could have people in 100 communities across the country giving us, you know, the human face on this and the human explanation that I can't get myself just by looking at decimal points and statistics.
Yeah, great. So this is a great piece against in National Affairs, Geography of Work, Nicholas Eberstadt and his tag team partner on that, Peter Van Ness. And Nicholas, this is just such great work, such important work, and it's a model not just on work, but on so many other areas where we're looking at policy or what's impacting society, where if we just look at the broad brush stuff, we're never ever going to get to the specifics in terms of what's actually going to have an impact and make a difference. So thanks for shining a light on that for us today, and always appreciate your great thinking, deep dives, and really good work at AEI. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Boyd.
It's so important that so many of these things that we hear, the answers are in community. We always say community and culture lead, the politicians will follow. So often the solution to what ails us as a nation, as a society, are those things that are hiding in plain sight. They're right in front of us. Far too often we allow those, especially in Washington and in national politics, the deciders and the definers, to distract us or to distort what's really going on or to prevent us from actually being curious enough to ask the questions to see what's actually happening and the results that are being produced in communities. It always comes back to community. All right, we'll step aside for one last commercial break. Final thoughts coming up on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back. Final segment of Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you today, as it always is. I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, I want to share a couple of thoughts with you that have been rolling around in my brain. And one real important one about a group of individuals who truly made a difference in this country and have never been given the proper recognition. The iconic Rosie the Riveter. Do you remember Rosie the Riveter? You've seen that iconic pic. She represents the women on the home front during World War II. They worked in positions previously only held by men. The Rosies, as they were known, worked in a variety of positions, building supplies for the war effort. And really interesting, over 310,000 women worked in the U.S. aircraft industry in 1943. They made up 65% of the industry's total workforce, and they were absolutely vital to the war effort. 11 of those women, known as Rosie the Riveters, were recently flown to Washington, D.C. as part of a very special honor flight. When I was in D.C., honor flights are the best of all the best things that happen in our nation's capital. And 11 of these former Rosie the Riveters were flown to D.C. for a special honor flight this week in celebration of Women's History Month as we round that out. There's no memorial dedicated to the women on the home front like the Rosies. But one young woman from Washington, D.C. is working to make one. Rhea Kenny has been working since she was just 10 years old to build the Women Who Worked on the Homefront Memorial. And she talked about the importance of a monument dedicated to the women in the workforce during World War II.
This is so important. There were 18 million civilian women who worked on the home front and completely changed the way that we view women in the workforce today.
Now, the process to get this monument approved has been a decade-long process. Right, Rhea gave her thoughts about why she thought it was important enough to continue with this, again, for a full decade, starting as a 10-year-old.
Having them represented in Washington, D.C. is just such a big and important thing and very vital to future generations, especially considering how few women are depicted in our national monuments and memorials, and it would be a really good and refreshing change.
I love that, and I think that's true. I don't think we have nearly enough women on the National Mall. One of the Rosies that was honored was Mae Creer, who is 95. She's one of the youngest of the surviving Rosies, so think of that. She was hired by Boeing in Seattle as a riveter to build B-17 and B-25 bombers. And here's what she had to say about Rhea's effort to build a memorial for the women who worked during World War II.
I didn't think too much of it. A child in fifth grade who got, you know, pipe dreams, and I thought, well, sooner or later she'll just quit. She never did. All of us Rosies are just so proud of her.
So, again, Rhea started as a fifth grader She's almost 20 now. And that's how long this process often takes in our nation's capital. Rhea herself described the moment that her monument idea passed the budgetary process in Congress. That's a big deal. Her hard work has paid off, and her dream is becoming a reality. It is within reach.
I got a text from a family friend that had gone through, and I was in the middle of a shift at work. And I said, excuse me for a second. And then I went upstairs to our gallery space, and I cried happy tears of joy.
Wow. You cried.
I did cry. I have never cried from happiness like that before. It was really, 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 it was such a relief, and it was so exciting. And it was just like the culmination of everything I'd worked for.
I love that. Rosie the Riveters deserve some recognition on the National Mall, and we hope that continues to move forward. And what a testament. We've been talking a lot about how committed the young people are to the principles of freedom and patriotism. I think this is a fifth grader who started as a fifth grader, who's now a 20-year-old, was willing to work for a decade to make sure that those who had been part of the war effort during World War II were properly honored in our nation's capital. And I love seeing some of the images today. If you haven't seen them, go check it out online. Some of these Rosie the Riveters who were in our nation's capital, 11 of them, to see them on the National Mall, to see them at the World War II Memorial is just an extraordinary thing, and well-deserved recognition. And those are people that we have to remember. That was great sacrifice during World War II, and a clear demonstration of what this country can do when we come together. No sacrifice too great. We can do amazingly, incredibly hard things in this country when we invite the American people to be part of it, that we're not dictating, that we're not playing things for political purposes, when we just figure out what actually matters and what things actually ring true. So big kudos to the Rosie the Riveters, and there aren't very many of them left, but we celebrate all of them and are grateful for their service and all that they've done. If you missed earlier today, we had a great conversation with Adam Kankeren from Politico, who did the ultimate piece on the new chief of staff for President Biden, Jeff Zients. And he talked about the fact that Jeff is learning that this is a very thankless job to be the chief of staff in the White House. And as we were going back and forth, I was teasing him that I had actually written something to my fellow chiefs of staff when I was one back in D.C., because it is a very unique job. It's not an easy one. It's a relentless one, actually. And I actually took to the old Paul Harvey, So God Made a Farmer, and mixed it up a little bit to make it about the chief of staff. And so I'm going to close out today with a little ode to all of the chiefs of staff, including the new chief of staff at the White House. And it goes like this. It says, when God looked down on the United States government, the seat of this great democracy, and realized that members of Congress and the president alone could never keep things running, he said, I need a caretaker. So God made a chief of staff. He needed somebody whose first thought in the morning and last thought at night would be about helping and serving a member of Congress or a president, who would rise before dawn and organize the day, set the strategy, deal with the thick of thin things, and steer their boss away from bad meetings, bad policy, and bad people, and who would work all day in and out of the office, skip holidays, birthdays, and parties in pursuit of their service, who would stay past midnight waiting for a vote, then would be willing to get up at the crack of dawn the next morning to do it all again. So God made a chief of staff. He needed somebody with thick skin, strong will, and a soft touch, strong enough to herd the cats that members of Congress often are, yet gentle enough to comfort a grieving constituent or citizen. Somebody to call balls and strikes, tame the cantankerous bureaucracy of government, creatively solve problems big and small, and patiently listen to a hostile citizen with an axe to grind, then telling them to be sure to come back and see us real soon and mean it. So God made a chief of staff. God said, I need someone that can shape a staff, shine shoes, horse trade for furniture and office space, navigate a litany of ethics and rules requirements, and play the role of cruise director for countless constituent tours of D.C. Somebody who will finish their 40-hour work week by Tuesday at noon, then put in another 72 hours on top of that. So God made a chief of staff. He had to have somebody willing to sprint at double speed to stay ahead of a news story and yet stop on a dime and pivot to help the real people of this country, who matter much more than the press or the powerful in this city. Somebody who, when the boss, senator, congressman, president, becomes surrounded by yes men and yes women, is willing to humbly yet firmly and resolutely say, no, sir, not that. So God made a chief of staff. He said, I need somebody strong enough to catch arrows, take heat, endure withering criticism, and patiently listen to angry voices. Somebody who is just fine with little prominence, praise, prestige, or perks, and who, above all, is fiercely loyal and forever has their boss's back. So God made a chief of staff. And just loved the piece from Adam from Politico talking about just the role of the president's chief of staff. It is a relentlessly brutal role with little recognition, no thanks, and a lot of armchair quarterbacks telling you you're doing it wrong. And so when we all pray for a president, for a senator, for a member of Congress, always make sure you pray for their chief of staff as well. All right, I'm Boyd Mathison. Thanks for joining us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.